Counsel in the second case may approach and get ready.
One-way door.
How are you?
Good.
The second case on today's oral argument calendar is case number A22-0998, Michael Robert Jacobson versus Dunja Vukosavovic. I'll be happy to be informed by respondent's counsel of the proper pronunciation. But, counsel for appellant, you may approach. I think both of you know you have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. So please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Esteemed judges, opposing counsel, may it please the court, my name is Jacob Erickson. I'm appearing on behalf of appellant Dunja Vukosavovic, which I believe is how you pronounce her last name. I've always just had to call her Dunja. This is a case, Your Honor, where we're asking the courts to review the district court's decision that there's personal jurisdiction over a Florida resident. We're asking this court to find on a de novo review that there is not personal jurisdiction to justify having the divorce here in Minnesota. We're asking that the district court be reversed and that the parties be allowed to get divorced in their original state of residence, Florida. My client is a foreign-born national. She originally lived in California. She moved to California to Florida. That's where the parties met. That's where they dated. It's where they were married. They own property there together. Though the respondent has indicated an intent.
And they own property here in Minnesota together, too. When I say that, it sounds as if I'm defining the type of ownership they have. What I'm trying to say is her name appears on property here in Minnesota.
Yes.
Lindstrom.
The respondent had a premarital rental property in Lindstrom, Minnesota, and he added her name to that deed. He also purchased the homestead in, and I forget the city, but down in Florida in Caldera County and added her name there as well. What's important for the application here is whereas respondent is saying, look, we intended to live at this property where I've rented in Lindstrom and this is our homestead, that's not what the parties had ever actually done, and it's not what the respondent had said to the Department of Immigration when he filed that application on our behalf. He never indicated that the Lindstrom property was a home that my client intended to live in. In fact, he didn't list it as a home that he had lived in for 5 years prior to the marriage.
But they rented it out then when they were in Naples, right? They rented out this Lindstrom property and the money came into the marital estate?
My client did not, Your Honor. She did not do anything to rent the property. And I don't think
as a married couple, they received the income from the rental property.
That is the legal argument that respondent is making to say that she engages in business here. I don't believe that my client has ever actually received any of the monies from the rental property, and I don't know if she has access to those funds. I know that respondent had transferred some money to an account that they had, but not that it was something where, like, the rental money was coming into that account. And that's the critical issue here when we look at doing business in the state of Minnesota, is that she is not actively engaged in doing anything in business in Minnesota. She's not advertising this property, she's not listed on the Airbnb site, she's not a contact, she hasn't done anything. Her interest is purely ancillary. And when the court looks at the cases that...
What do you mean by ancillary?
It's a passive benefit she's receiving. She's not doing anything. It's just merely by virtue of being married, there's this marital interest, and therefore she gets this benefit. And the reason that that's important is when we look at cases like the TRWL case cited in my responsive brief, that kind of passive action is not sufficient to justify a personal jurisdiction. There has to be some active engagement. And even when businesses have been found to actually be actively doing business and selling to Minnesota residents, those have not been found to be sufficient to confer personal jurisdiction over them.
What about the mere fact of her ownership of the land?
That's the initial threshold issue to meet the statute, Your Honor.
But under the constitutional analysis, is that a factor? Is it a strong factor?
I don't believe that it's a strong factor, but it is a factor. And I would draw attention to the Schaefer case, which is on page 13 of my brief, to indicate that the presence of property in Minnesota alone is not enough to satisfy due process. It's just enough to indicate there might be something else there. And
what about, I'll let you continue.
Okay. The best legal argument that I can kind of, or the best analogy I can think of for the argument that had been made previously with, if you satisfy due process, you've naturally satisfied the statute, is, all dogs are poodles, but not all poodles, or all poodles are dogs, but not all dogs are poodles. Just because you satisfy due process and therefore satisfy the Minnesota statute doesn't mean that if you satisfy the Minnesota statute, you automatically satisfy the due process issue.
But in this appeal, the statute's not an issue, right? The parties, you agree the statute's been satisfied?
Correct.
So we're just concerned with the due process analysis?
Correct.
Yeah. And would you agree that we, when considering the facts, I mean, there's a lot of, you bring up a lot of facts, I think, that you introduced before the district court, but I mean, would you agree that we, at this stage of the case, we're looking at the petitioner's presentation of the facts in the petition and in his accompanying affidavit?
Now, this is going to sound like a very, I don't want the answer to sound disingenuous, so I'm just going to do it. That is the general rule, yes. However, in this case, there are facts that are handled differently. Some of these facts were already found at the prior case where it was dismissed, namely the finding by the district court that dismissed respondent's first divorce petition, that the only real contact with Minnesota is that my client had just been added by respondent to the deed. Because that's a finding of fact after a motion hearing that hasn't been appealed, that's not subject to collateral attack. So regardless of if respondent asserts different facts from that now, the court shouldn't review those facts because they're already precluded by law from being found.
So that sounds like you're talking about issue preclusion, are you? Collateral estoppel? Was that doctrine in play in the district court?
Or in your brief to this court?
That's in my responsive brief, Your Honor, and I should have marked that. I apologize. I also have to note that I...
What about to the district court? Because they're separate issues, but both important for us to know as we think about whether that's a live issue for us. Was that presented, the collateral estoppel, or you can't collaterally attack a finding of fact from a dismissed case between the same parties? Is that an argument presented to the district court?
I believe
only presented to us for the first time in your reply brief.
No, I believe that was to the district court. But even if it wasn't, because this is a jurisdictional challenge, all jurisdictional elements may be raised for the first time, even on appeal. So whether it was specifically stated to the district court or not would not legally preclude me from that argument. And I'm sorry, I want to make sure that I get the other answer too, and I don't miss that. Pages 6 and 7... citing the KESOW case, KIESOW, we've held in other types of cases that an order made in determining a motion after a full hearing has been had on a controverted question of fact and which is appealable is binding upon the parties in subsequent action or motion and conclusive upon the point passed upon. So these factual findings that were made previously in the original, original Minnesota divorce that was dismissed would be preclusive. It wouldn't be subject to attack now for the purposes of trying to create personal jurisdiction.
And could you repeat what was that finding again or conclusion?
That conclusion...
And where is it found in the record?
The finding of fact would be that, and I use the appellate designations, appellant's only meaningful contact with Minnesota is respondent's addition of appendant's name to the rental property in Chisago County, Minnesota. That's page 4 of my initial brief. I believe, and I apologize, I don't have access to the index numbers, and it's not always clear
right
which ones are in there.
Okay,
but I have that as index 13, but the prior order was attached as an exhibit to my client's affidavit, but it might have been 19, not 13.
Petitioner stated in his affidavit that that shortly after the marriage, she requested that he add her name to the deed of the Minnesota property. He said that she insisted on it, and his affidavit said that he did so because of her request and her insistence. For purposes of the motion and this appeal, would you agree that we take that as true?
No, but for a different reason than stated before. And that's the other argument of issues with factual assertions by respondent, in that this court does not condone perjury. And his actual statement was, I put her on the deed in Lindstrom, Minnesota, because it was supposed to help her with her immigration process. And the reason that that statement by respondent is, frankly, perjurious is it's directly contrary to Exhibit 3, which would be index number 21.
Isn't it true that we're taking the pleadings and the motion assertions by the petitioner? I think the general rule is the petitioner's allegations of fact are deemed true at the outset. You may wish later on in the case to prove that that's perjurious, but isn't that something for later determination on a motion to dismiss at the outset? Isn't it true that the case law says we take the petitioners or the plaintiffs' alleged facts as true?
I would say that that is the general rule, but there are other rules that would contradict.
And you're talking about this Kiso case?
Right, that the facts that have already been found.
Mm-hmm. In the Kiso case, it seems to be pretty different, right? The issue there was there was litigation over who owns real estate. And the time for appealing that judgment in the dissolution had expired. The remedy then is motion for new trial or appeal from the judgment, but because it was related to property, that judgment was final. That seems pretty different than what we have here, where the remedy for a dismissed complaint is potentially to draft a new complaint and file a new complaint. Where is the prejudicial effect of dismissing this previous complaint that would preclude as a remedy in the same way that a final dissolution decree that is dividing property is preclusive of a subsequent attempt to do that same thing? Where's that analogy? Because I think that Kiso might not be applicable here.
Well, I mean, certainly every case is going to be somewhat different.
Right, but I'm not saying that the facts are I'm saying it's fundamentally seems like a different issue. When Kiso is decided because there's a dissolution decree dividing property, that's final, and if you want to challenge that, you can only go through the remedy of appeal. That seems pretty different than a complaint being dismissed where remedies could include a new complaint. So unless you can show where, in this case, that remedy of a new complaint it was dismissed with prejudice, or there's some other language that precludes someone from filing a new complaint, I don't see the analogy there, and I think we're back to that general rule.
Well, Your Honor, frequently we come into court and we cite cases. We cite cases for, legal rules or black letter, regardless of what they are. And occasionally we'll cite criminal cases and family cases, even though they're night and day different, and the facts are very different, the outcomes are different.
Right. But is there any indication in the first dismissal that was intended to preclude a new complaint? Was it dismissed with prejudice? Or is there any other language similar to that?
Your Honor, we're not seeking a dismissal with prejudice. We're seeking to have the divorce filed in Florida. And the reason for that is when he filed his first divorce in Florida, he said he'd lived there for 6 months but hadn't, and it was dismissed for subject matter jurisdiction. He moved to Minnesota, which is cited in the Davies case, is not something Minnesota respects. We don't like people just moving someplace to get a divorce. He filed without living in Minnesota for 180 days, and then that's where that second dismissal came about. We don't have subject matter jurisdiction.
Correct. So I guess, to be very precise, I don't see how Kiso gets around the general rule unless there's something in that dismissal for lack of jurisdiction because he didn't live in the state for 180 days that would preclude him from filing a new petition.
Well, I'm really just citing Kiso for the issue preclusion rule, which is once you've had a determination after having a hearing and the facts are found, you can't come back at a separate hearing.
And again, I think that that's specific to a fact finding relating to property division in a dissolution decree that you can't, after the fact, challenge. That property division is final. That doesn't seem to be extended as far as you're asking us to extend it, to allow some fact in a dismissal without prejudice of a complaint to preclude litigation of that fact in a second complaint. That seems to be a fundamental difference, and it doesn't seem to be applicable. And then we're back to the general rule that we assume the allegations in the second complaint are true.
What I'm hearing is that the Kiso case has very different facts from this case, and therefore Kiso wouldn't generally be applied in this matter.
What I'm saying is I think you're extrapolating a rule from Kiso that just doesn't apply to the dismissal of a complaint that is not dismissed without prejudice. Not so much that the facts are distinguishable, but the rule of law you're asking us to apply doesn't exist out of the Kiso case. There may be other cases, but I still think as a matter of law, we're left with looking at the complaint and the allegations of fact in the complaint is true for purposes of deciding this issue.
I'm sorry, I'm out of time. May I respond?
Oh, yes, of course.
Thank you. Even if the court were to take all the facts as are alleged by respondent, we would still say that personal jurisdiction doesn't exist. On the Kiso case, I'm not meaning to suggest that Kiso is the case that we should look at. I'm only citing it for this rule that once a finding of fact has been made, even in a motion, it's subject to appeal and it hasn't been appealable. That finding of fact has now been determined conclusively and can't be challenged later. I understand that what you're saying is that I seem to be that I'm over-extrapolating that rule, and really the only way that I could, because I hadn't contemplated that, the only way I could give a proper response would be to file an additional brief. Thank you.
Before you sit down, I was going to ask, so, I mean, I want to go back to her interest in the property. You cited the Schaefer case. I mean, that case seems to, you know, it says, I'm looking at it now, page 2581-207, when claims to property itself are the source of the underlying controversy between a plaintiff and a defendant, it would be unusual for the state where the property is located not to have jurisdiction. In such cases, the defendant's claim to property located in the state would normally indicate that the defendant expected to benefit from the state's protection of the interest. Doesn't that support jurisdiction more than not?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because the issue isn't the real estate. This isn't like the estate case.
What is the issue?
The dissolution of the party's marriage.
Yeah, but it's no-fault divorce. There's no dispute that there's been an irretrievable breakdown of the marriage, right?
That's true.
So, I mean, if you had a trial in Minnesota or in Florida on this dissolution, what would be the issues to be tried before the trial court judge?
Well, there'd be definition of what does and doesn't constitute marital property and how it should be resolved, and those issues may be, between the states, they may be very different. I'm not licensed in Florida, so I don't know.
And basically how to divide the property that are owned by the parties.
Well, to divide their real estate, vehicles, determine if there should be ongoing medical assistance. I mean, I don't think that spousal support would be in this case.
Realistically, in a marriage that lasted 4 months, I don't know. What? Did they buy any new vehicles in the 4 months? It's really all about the property, right?
Well, and if that's the case, it's as much a Florida issue as it is a Minnesota issue, because they own arguably a more valuable piece of property in Florida. So anything that would support jurisdiction here supports jurisdiction much more in Florida, which also happens to be where the parties were married, which is the true subject of the action is dissolving that marriage. And my client still lives there, and the respondent lived there previously, absconding from that state simply to try to get a divorce in another state.
It is possible that two different states could have jurisdiction over the divorce.
Two different types of dogs.
Yeah, there are multiple dogs definitely in this fight. The issue I think still comes back to, yes, there might be some property there, but because property is only the first threshold question, that doesn't go into the rest of the due process analysis. And because my client isn't purposely availing herself of doing business here. She purposely availed herself of Florida. Respondent purposely availed himself of Florida. She's chosen to live there. And any interest that she has coming from Minnesota is really just kind of grown out of the fact that she's married. That's not an active action by her part. That's just a passive acquisition, which in the TWL case and the Walker case indicate isn't sufficient. So the mere fact that the real estate is here is not the end of the analysis, and that none of the cases suggest that that's the case.
One more question, if I may, at this point, and that is you made reference to the immigration document that was signed by Mr. Jacobson. I forget the title of the document, but I mean, that was the basis for your statement that he had perjured himself in the affidavit, right?
Correct, Your Honor. That's a sworn statement to immigration. It's Exhibit 3 to the affidavit. I believe it's index number 21.
I've seen it. So if we consider that document, do we also consider the fact that it was prepared by her attorney, Ms. Baskin? The document says she was the preparer of the document, so I'm just wondering how that factors into...
I mean, you could, but it's the affiant signature that he swore to it, and it seems to undermine the suggestion that my client's attorney is the one that said you have to put him on the Lindstrom property because it's going to help with the immigration case if that attorney didn't put it in the petition. So really, it just goes to further undermine respondents' suggestions. But I would say that it's his sworn statement, not the attorney's, and so that's why it should be held against him.
Okay. Thank you. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name's Tim Lees. I'm the attorney for Mr. Jacobson, who is the respondent in this matter. And just while my head is there, just because it was toward the end of the questions, you know, one interesting thing as I read the law about dissolution of marriage is the court here does have jurisdiction to dissolve the marriage. What it doesn't have is the jurisdiction to divide the property. So the underlying litigation here is directly related to that property. We've obviously, the court and everybody has really boiled down to the issue here, and that is, in this case, does land ownership in Minnesota, together with the marital income coming from that property, does that satisfy... minimum contacts and due process.
Mr. Lees, before you go forward, I just want to go back to your first comment
yeah.
to make sure I understand what you're saying. I think what you're saying is what's at issue in this appeal is whether Ms. Bukosabovich is a party to this action or not. In her absence, the court could dissolve the marriage but could not issue any orders that directly affect her property interests.
That is correct.
And so I think the motion to dismiss was to get her out of the case. The case could remain in Minnesota if petitioner wished. I mean, if she were successful...
Correct, to get the divorce.
...in her motion. But what we're... So what the purpose of the appeal is I guess, if you're successful on appeal, then the result would be the court would have all authorities under the dissolution statute.
Correct. We would have an efficient... disposition, or we would have efficient justice there. We would be dealing with everything, the divorce, the property division, everything related to that.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood. I wanted to make sure that I understood your statement of the issue.
Yes, Judge Bryan.
Sometimes in divorces, and there are disputes around other issues, spousal maintenance or assistance or you know, even when it comes to property, there may be a dispute about whether something acquired since the marriage is marital or non-marital and whatnot. But if the, and sometimes there's even disputes about whether to get divorced.
Yeah.
There are times when a party does not want a divorce. And so you have potentially a dispute on whether there's been an irretrievable breakdown in the marital relationship. But if that's off the table, and given the length of this marriage, is there really anything else in dispute other than real property, specifically the property that has been mentioned here?
Honestly, yeah. And that's what I anticipate as part of the divorce case, and what's alluded to or stated in the affidavits is if
If we look at how this timeline unraveled, my client meets the appellant in what was late 2020, early 2021.
What are the issues apart from property division? Because I'm looking at the third factor in determining personal jurisdiction, and we have to determine whether the connection of the cause of action, what connection that has to the contacts, which means what is the cause of action, which then means in this particular dissolution proceeding, what are the primary issues?
Well, I imagine it's going to be the disposition of the real estate, you know, with and
I presume is the rental income, or I don't, it wasn't really rental income, but the income coming in from the property, though.
Right, and at this point, we don't know what the appellant's claims are going to be against the divorce petition. I don't know if she's going to ask for maintenance.
It doesn't seem like much of a maintenance case given the duration of the marriage, but possible.
I don't think so either, but it happens, and you can kind of see some of the argument being laid out. She's a foreign-born national and kind of playing down her functionality or ability to get by. So that's going to be an issue. And with the real estate, as we all know, over the last, you know, since January, what the market's done with the huge spike, and now it's starting to correct, I don't know what that's going to do to the valuation. And but that could make an otherwise likelihood of having no marital interest in the property or no increase in value, that could throw a wrench into that. So the main issue, Your Honor, is going to be the division of that property. And I want to underscore again, and I know everybody's aware of it, but I want to underscore that we're at a very specific point in time in this proceeding. And that is just to be looking at a prima facie case. Did what Mr. Jacobson say, if the trial court believes everything, does that constitute facts sufficient to find the minimum contacts and to find jurisdiction here? And the law tells us if it's a close call, we say there is jurisdiction. And the reason for that is, and a lot of the things and arguments you've heard today are things that are gonna have to be vetted more. In other words, if the court decides with this case that my client made a prima facie case of personal jurisdiction, that issue isn't dead. That can still all now be vetted as part of the divorce process. And there's going to be a lot of vetting both ways on this. And we need to let that process run. For example, if there's claims that my client perjured himself somehow with the filling out of these forms, and that impacts his credibility in the divorce case, she has the opportunity to do all of that. And really get into this business. Was she just passively involved? We've got very limited information here, as did the trial court. We've got very limited information, but what was her involvement in that? With the being added to the deed, it's being presented to the court as this was a very passive thing. The day after these parties got married, she was on the phone with a lawyer, I believe in New York, and after that call came to him and demanded that he get her on the deed now. And so they very quickly got a deed done. I don't think that's part of the record, and got that filed. That is her affirmative act. I very unusual for the day after a wedding for one spouse to be saying, all right, I talked to my lawyer now. I need you adding me to that property. So again, that's another issue that can be fully vetted and explored.
And but maybe you could respond a bit to the argument that there's some preclusive effect to what's been characterized as findings in the initial dismissal for lack of residency, meeting the residency requirement.
Sure. Yeah. And the one thing I would point out is that really that part of the proceeding really was focused on the residency requirement. My impression of it in reading the brief was consistent kind of with the questions Your Honor was posing to counsel, that I don't think, I'm not understanding what specific statement that the district court relied on here was apparently or arguably perjurious or untrue, or I'm sorry, not was stopped by that prior order. What finding? And I'm still not understanding what that is. Now, the court made a finding that on the 180-day requirement, he misled the that my client misled the court. And for that, the appellant received an award of attorney's fees. But I don't think anything in that order precludes us from addressing the issues we've got before the court now. Again, these aren't these findings and these orders are only at a preliminary stage. This hasn't been through the evidentiary and fact-finding process. And again, it's kind of why this is set up this way. We can make the prima facie case and move forward, and after all the information is vetted and exchanged and factual findings are made by the trial court, then if there's a basis to appeal that jurisdiction, she can do so. But now we're dealing with the full record, and a lot of the questions we're all here asking and trying to answer, we'll have information for. So again, we've got to recognize the, and I know you are, it's important to recognize the point in the proceeding we're at, and that's merely, okay, did the judge take the facts that Mr. Jacobson alleged as true, and if so, did those rise to the level of conferring or supporting personal jurisdiction?
What do you think about appellant's argument that, I think I'm, this is my understanding and perhaps restatement of appellant's argument, but I think he's saying that the evidence that you and your client put in sometimes includes some legal conclusions or it includes some inferences or from facts, and that it should be understood, we should construe the factual record to focus on tangible actions she actually engaged in rather than perhaps, legal consequences or imputed legal consequences that might flow from her actions or that flow from the whole circumstances.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that last night, too, going through these things. And the one, I think, in our statement of facts finding that was called out was a statement that she injected herself into the commerce of that was a fact from the court's order. You're right on that. That probably is a legal conclusion and isn't a fact. But I still don't think that our argument hinges on that at all.
So maybe you're going on, but if you want to complete your answer, go ahead.
I have a follow-up question,
which is one of the statements by the district court. I'm looking at page 5 of the order, paragraph 9. The respondent's name is on the Minnesota Properties Deed. That's, I think, a given. And she has benefited from the property's use as an Airbnb rental. Would you agree with that statement?
I would agree with that statement, yes.
Okay. But, and how has she benefited?
While they're married, that money is coming into the marriage. They are spending that money. They are enjoying that money. It's become part of their cash flow.
And is there evidence in the record that she has access to that cash?
I don't want to speak out of school, but in my review, I seem to have remembered one issue was, yes, she had taken $70,000 out of their account and moved it to a different account. So did she have access to that money? Absolutely. She still has access to the house. She's still living there. At this time, does she have access to that money? No, I don't think they're sharing funds at this time, though I'm not involved really in the, I'm very limited to the appeal in my involvement here.
I guess I'm wondering if that statement is, based on what I might call sort of the actual facts, the reality that, in real life she has access to the money, or is it more a statement about her marital interest in property owned by a spouse?
Yeah, and again, that's where we're looking at a pretty finite record here and something that has to be explored. My client's testimony to the court, the district court, was she has yes, she has had access to these funds. And again, if she had access to $70,000, she certainly had access to this, or that was part of that money. I don't know.
So where do I find the evidence of that $70,000 transfer? Is it in his affidavit or elsewhere? I mean, there's not that many evidentiary sources so far.
No, and that's why I was hesitant to. I'm
maybe outside the record.
Boy, I would be surprised, just because my involvement with the case has been limited to the record. Would it be all right if the court, if I kind of mull that over in my brain, and I, because I'm down to a minute, and there's one more point I would like to make.
Yeah, please proceed. We will.
The difference in this case, Your Honors, a lot of the cases, especially the paternity cases, are looking at relationship issues. And being in Minnesota is almost just kind of happenstance. I mean, if two people are having a relationship, theoretically they could be having a relationship in Iowa or South Dakota or New York and different states. What makes this unique is we're not talking about a relationship. We're talking about ownership of the state of Minnesota. In other words, she owns part of this state. How much more connected can you be?
So, Mr. Lees, I think good question. It makes common sense. The district court said on page 3, by virtue of owning land, she has minimum contacts, but there's no case law citation in support of the... But wait, what's the best legal authority for
you
that
know,
proposition?
I hate to do it because we're loath to do it, but the one unpublished, the one case I found that really, I think, addressed... may I continue just briefly?
Yes, of course.
Which I think really addressed the real estate ownership question was the estate of Conoran. And I know it's unpublished, Your Honors. I'm not trying to tell you that you have to follow that. But I think the reasoning in that case is persuasive. And throughout that case, they're citing Minnesota case law, and they're citing United States Supreme Court case law to back that up. And in that case, not one of the parties had ever stepped foot in Minnesota. Let me say that again. None of them had ever even been in the state. They didn't, the business dealings were all in Arizona. And the court said, yes, there's personal jurisdiction. And the court can read that opinion. I do think it's persuasive. And I avoid coming up here trying to argue unpublished cases. But this one is unique. I think this goes to the issue. I really do. That real estate ownership is special. And we all know in the law, we've always treated real estate as special. It is unique. It is one of a kind, and it is permanent. A relationship can move from Minnesota. Businesses can move from Minnesota. That piece of land is Minnesota. And you combine that with the totality of the circumstances here, the money generated, and the fact that she is a real estate owner before this marriage. So she's savvy. She understands that when you own real estate, you are subject to laws where that real estate is, and you are subject to protections.
I think you've answered my last question. If you wish to sum up, you may.
Your Honors, it's a prima facie case that's been made. We submit, and it may be a close call. And if that's the case... The order should be affirmed, and we should move forward with this divorce, and all these issues can be vetted further as the process intends. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lees. Mr. Hagler, no, excuse me, Mr. Erickson, you have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue here is whether or not, under due process, it is reasonable for my client to expect to be dragged to Minnesota for court action. And under these facts, it's not. She has an ownership interest in Minnesota property, not challenged. We could even say that she actively asked for that, because that's what respondent is suggesting. You could assume that as well. All that does is satisfy the statute. The district court is saying she has a business interest, there's money coming in, therefore, legally, she has acted in business in Minnesota.
What about the legal authority, Mr. Lees made his argument about the importance of ownership of real property, Minnesota dirt. What is the legal consequence of that?
The unpublished case that he cites to was an interim action dealing specifically with the dirt. That's not the case here. This is still a divorce. The dirt is
right,
one of many
issues. Right, but it cites to a due process jurisdiction case from the United States Supreme Court when claims to the property itself are the source of the underlying controversy. It would be unusual for the state where the property is located not to have jurisdiction. That's a quote directly from the U.S. Supreme Court case from 1977, so it's not as if it's plucked out of thin air.
But the real estate isn't the source of issue here. They're not getting divorced because they own real estate in Minnesota. They're getting divorced because they have a marriage, and that marriage has some impacts on other property issues. But to get to something that was asked by Your Honor, this isn't just about the real estate in Lindstrom, and it's not just about the real estate in Florida. Respondent has indicated that there are torts. He suggested that the $70,000 that he transferred immediately after the marriage, which isn't the interest from the future rentals that's addressed in the affidavits, is money that was taken from him. He's complained of a breach of contract where he tried to rent the rental property in Florida out from under my client. They moved in there. He moved back to Minnesota. He tried to rent it when she was still there, and then got mad at her because she didn't move out for the renters, and claims a breach of contract. Those issues also go into what is in this marital this dissolution, what needs to be addressed. Those issues are all based in Florida. And when the court looks at the Walker case that talks about the elements of formation of the agreements, most of these agreements that are being addressed were all created in Florida by, at that time, Florida residents. And to suggest that this incidental contact is sufficient to drag her into Minnesota is contrary to both Walker Management and the TRWL case. And this is why I bring up that, like, it's ancillary or incidental that she has this business interest. These incidental contacts as a result of unilateral activity by another party do not satisfy due process. And we do have evidence that respondent has acted unilaterally, and it's from his own affidavit. On page 8 of my brief, I cite his affidavit, which is index 25. I, respondent, stated earlier, I rented the Lindstrom Naples property on Airbnb and other forums as a source of income prior to our marriage. I, singular, continued to rent both properties during our marriage as a source of marital income. He is the one unilaterally acting, and he is the one who has told us that that's the case. So there is no factual assertion by respondent that my client has done anything to actively engage in that business, which is his sole basis for suggesting jurisdiction be personal in this case.
It's not the sole basis, is it?
That is his sole basis. He says that there's the ownership, but that's enough to get into the statute.
I thought you were referring to the district court's reasoning.
The district court's reasoning, and again, this is a de novo review. The district court made a lot of factual findings that I don't believe are supported by the record to get to the final decision of, look, the preference is just that we do jurisdiction and we should bring people in. And we can't dispense with due process so cavalierly. The Supreme Court has indicated that that's not sufficient. Cases that previously would have allowed it to go forward, that Sherburn case basically saying, no, just having sex in Minnesota, having a baby here is not enough for personal jurisdiction, suggest that that's not the threshold. It's not sufficient that there's just a Minnesota resident and the other person owns some property here and maybe get some benefits from Minnesota. The other person has to have actively acted in a way that would justify them to reasonably believe they were going to be dragged to court in Minnesota. And nothing that appellant has done suggests that that was ever her intent or that that was something she expected would happen at the formation of the marriage contract, which is what we're seeking to dissolve, which is the actual subject of this action and the appeal.
So you're saying that a person who owns property in a given state should not expect to be hailed into court in that state?
I own a timeshare property in Mexico. I wouldn't expect to be dragged to Mexico and subject to a divorce there.
But isn't that contrary to Schaefer?
No, because Schaefer says that it's not enough to just look at the real estate. The real estate might give you more information to look into, but that in and of itself isn't that alone. And it says the presence of the property in Minnesota suggests other ties, but it's not sufficient for due process. You have to look at the other due process factors.
It also says, though, that a claim to property would normally indicate there's an expected benefit from the state's protection of that claimed interest, which seems to to go back to just mere interest or claimed interest in property could be enough.
I believe that the law on due process is that there has to be that expectation to be dragged in, and mere foreseeability, which again is cited in my brief, is not sufficient. So just simply owning property in another state, if you have a rental home or a vacation home in another state, doesn't mean that you should expect to be dragged for a divorce there. If somebody slipped and fell on your property, you might have an expectation to be dragged there because you're dealing specifically with the property. But when you're dealing with the divorce and that contract and those other issues, I don't think that you have an expectation just because you might own stock in a company or you might own a portion of real estate someplace else. And I'm sorry, I'm out of time.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you for your rebuttal argument. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks, Jake.